Hello, Sean here. Welcome back to Dilettantry. Welcome to part two of talking about David Lewis Williams and his broad theory of rock art and how it might be tied to shamanism in a deeper way than people think. Last episode, we talked a lot about the San in southern Africa, but Lewis Williams also looks at North American rock art to see if there's any commonalities between rock art of shamanistic societies with no known influence on each other. Since Amerindian shamanisms are thought to be distantly related to Siberian shamanisms, like they come from the same or a similar source, according to a fairly general consensus, from what I can tell. But African shamanic cultures, like the San, are thought to have developed without any connection to either Siberian or Amerindian shamanisms. Like, analyses don't show any myths or shared terms that are too similar to be a coincidence. So Lewis Williams is thinking that if there's evidence of rock art in two areas being inextricably connected to shamanic hallucinations that are similar to laboratory hallucinatory experiences, then we can look backwards into prehistory for these commonalities in prehistoric rock art as well, like at those famous European sites. Maybe not all of the rock art or cave art, as we'll get to, but maybe some of the prehistoric cultures in France and Spain were also shamanic and left clues that are in the same shape as the clues in more contemporary shamanic rock art, sometimes literally the same shape. And although every Amerindian culture is distinct, of course, Lewis Williams looks at their shamanic, animistic cosmologies and rock art generally, more of an overview to see if there are similarities, because Lewis Williams' expertise is with the San. And he finds them. Again, hallucinators in many North American indigenous cultures experience a tunnel or a hole. It goes even further than that, getting closer to rock art. David Whitley, an American archaeologist, says that, quote, entering a cave or rock was a metaphor for a shaman's altered state. Therefore, caves and rocks more generally were considered entrances or portals to the supernatural world, unquote. And again, the opposite is also common, experiencing flying or entering clouds. Many North American indigenous cultures have traditions of what are usually translated as vision quests, where people, shamans and non-shamans, go into the wilderness alone, using the solitude to aid their visions. The goal is to see a spirit animal that will become their ally, connected to them in some deep way that gives them some sort of power or ability. Often the person on the vision quest finds it hard to tell if they are dreaming or awake. So visions or hallucinations, in the modern term, are a big thing in many North American indigenous cultures, of course with shamans, but also often with regular people as well. But are these hallucinations connected to their rock art as deeply as the San seem to be? A similar thing to what happened in southern Africa with the San happened in North America. Someone named Thomas Blackburn was trying to understand Amerindian cultures without the language and framework of structuralism, which was big when he was around. Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist, had become the go-to researcher for Amerindian cultures because he published this monumental four-volume work analyzing related myths in indigenous cultures that started at the bottom of South America with a myth from the Bororo people and followed similar myths from culture to culture northward, all the way to the Arctic. I found it strangely hard to find summaries of this work online, but I think the idea is that this was one myth that evolved and changed from culture to culture, and was based on binary oppositions. Lévi-Strauss was a structuralist, the most well-known one in anthropology at the time and now, and he analyzed these myths using certain language and certain theoretical frameworks, like this focus on binary opposition. But Blackburn wanted to understand the myths in a different way, how they related to the culture who created the given myth only, rather than what Lévi-Strauss did, analyzing how one culture's myth related to a similar myth of a nearby culture. It's like a comparative thing to try to get, to try to understand the structure of structuralism. Luckily for Blackburn, there was another extensive archive from the early days of anthropology, from somebody named John Peabody Harrington, an anthropologist and linguist who acquired data from pretty much every North American linguistic group that he could contact. And again, just like in Southern Africa, this archive was unpublished, 400 boxes of notes kept somewhere in the Smithsonian, gathering dust. Blackburn used this data to offer a different explanation of North American rock art. In North America, as long as Western academics had been looking at rock art, they had made some connection between it and shamanism, since shamanism is so obviously central in so many Amerindian cultures. So they're already ahead of the San rock art specialists at the beginning. There's no guy sailing in from Europe to convince people that figures of Africans with penises were actually European women. However, there's still lots of misconception that Blackburn was able to correct decades later. One is that many of the explanations were of the hunting magic type. We talked about this a few episodes ago. It's kind of related to shamanism, but it's a much more utilitarian understanding of the art, as though art is a tool for hunting and nothing else. It kind of separates art from the rest of the society. It makes it too utilitarian, if you think back to 3.2. There's also a widespread belief, definitely still persisting, that overemphasizes astronomical uses for the rock art. From what I've read, there is some of that, but a lot of it was hypothesized in the 70s and has since been overturned. Like there's a famous site in Utah where there's a sign that says supernova in the rock art, and it's pointing up at this shape, but more recent analysis thinks that that is a misinterpretation. Like, rock art connected to celestial events and stuff is a lot cooler than rock art that's just like, oh, that's just a pretty shape. So I think a lot of that analysis was kind of looking at rock art that's connected to celestial events and ignoring rock art that isn't, to make it seem like that's the main purpose of North American rock art. I've read a few papers arguing back and forth about certain rock art in the US that some think are related to things like supernovas or eclipses, and the people who are more skeptical in general convince me more than those who are all for it. You know, it starts to feel a little bit ancient alien-y sometimes. Of course, this doesn't mean that none of the examples are connected to celestial events or objects, just that it was kind of an academic fad for a bit that led to an overemphasis on that hypothesis. Anyways, back to Blackburn. Instead of trying to read all 400 boxes, Blackburn just focused on one of the main cultures that Harrington spent time with, the Chumash of California. Blackburn, after reading the related parts of the archive, concluded that the Chumash shamans were the ones who made the rock art. He also noted geometries similar to the ones drawn by the San that are similar to stage 1 entoptic phenomena. After Blackburn, the archaeologist I quoted a minute ago, David Whitley, followed him, but focused more singularly on rock art and was very prolific in creating this new understanding. Another false notion about Amerindian rock art predominant in academia at the time was that the ethnographic record didn't contain much information about who made the rock art. David Whitley analyzed the data in a more thorough, or maybe more honest way, or both, and found that there were many examples of informants from various cultures telling ethnographers who made the art or why it was made, usually by shamans, and often involved in these vision quests. Many indigenous North Americans called the sites where rock art was something like the shaman's cache, or the doctor's cave, or the shaman's medicine house, or something similar, and believed that this place for the shaman was not on the surface of the rock where the art was, but rather inside, and that shamans could enter the rock through openings invisible to non-shamans, entering the spirit world. Other times, this place is called what's translated as whirlwind place, likely a reference to the flying power of shamans, or sometimes it's called a place to go under. So again, there's references to flying and going underground, two common hallucinatory experiences. Anna Gayton was an anthropologist specializing in indigenous cultures of California. She describes how Yokut shamans typically enter one of these caches. She says, quote, "When a man had dreamed sufficiently, all the animals of his moiety gathered on a hill near a cache. The man was there too, and the animals opened the cache, telling him to enter. He stayed in there for 4 days. No one knew where he was, and often people went in search of him. While he was in the cache, the animals told him what to do. They gave him songs and danced with him all night. They gave him his regalia, This just appeared on him. Nobody knew where it came from. At the end of the 4 days, the animals sent him out. Unquote. David Lewis Williams gives an example of vision quests, looking at the Wind River Shoshone of Wyoming, who traditionally go on vision quests regardless of whether they're shamans or not, similar to at least some sand cultures where most people develop shamanistic abilities during the trance dance, or maybe it might be a male thing, I'm not sure about that. In other cultures where shamans and witches and similar figures, they are particular individuals, and they often live on the edge of society, literally and metaphorically, straddling worlds. Lewis Williams says about the Wind River Shoshone, quote, "The principal aim of a vision quest is to see a spirit animal that will become the quester's animal helper and source of his power. Amongst the Shoshone, a suppliant desiring a vision mounts his horse and rides up into the hills where there are already rock images. He washes, and clothed in only a blanket, he lies down on a ledge below the images. His vision is induced by fasting, enduring cold and a lack of sleep, and smoking hallucinogenic tobacco. Some reports say that it may take 3 or 4 days before a vision comes to the suppliant, if at all. It is hard to tell if the vision comes when the quester is awake or dreaming. Sometimes tobacco was smoked prior to sleep. Drug-induced hallucinations would thus be experienced during sleep. People may also experience spontaneous waking visions." Unquote. The thing about the vision quester not knowing if they're awake or dreaming is interesting. If we think back to last episode and Lewis Williams's notion of the spectrum of consciousness, this gets to how the Shoshone conceptualize it. They have a word that refers to both dreaming and being awake. Some other cultures with similar traditions and cosmologies also have a word that denotes both. Lewis Williams interprets this as the Shoshone understanding information from dreams and waking life as on the same level, or at least a very similar level. In westernized modernity, people often conceptualize it as an oppositional dichotomy, right? Waking life is real, or the truth, and dreams are unreal, they're lies invented by your brain just going haywire. That part about the spirit animal becoming an animal helper is also interesting. I don't know about the Shoshone, but many non-modern, small-scale hunter cultures acquire an animal helper that isn't just spiritual. It's really crazy, and obviously from a modernist framework, you wonder how true exactly this is, but according to informants from many of these hunter cultures, hunters ally with a specific member of the species they hunt, who helps them on the hunt. The anthropologist Philippe Descola sums up some of these practices, saying, quote, "It would be mistaken to regard this humanization of animals as mere intellectual playfulness, a kind of metaphorical language relevant only within the circumstances surrounding the performance of rites or the recounting of myths. Even when speaking in altogether prosaic terms of tracking, killing, and eating game, the Indians unambiguously convey the idea that hunting is a mode of social interaction with entities that are well aware of the conventions that regulate it. Here, as in most societies in which hunting plays an important part, it is by showing one's respect for the animals that one ensures their connivance. It is important to avoid waste, to kill cleanly and without causing undue suffering, to treat the bones and remains with dignity, and never indulge in boasting or even to refer too clearly to the fate that awaits one's prey. Expressions referring to hunting seldom mention its ultimate end, the kill. Just as the Achuar of Amazonia speak vaguely of going off into the forest, of walking the dogs, or of blowing the birds when it is a matter of blowpipe hunting, so too the Montagnais Indians say that they're going to search when they mean to hunt with a rifle, or going to see when they mean to check on their traps. Likewise, in Amazonia, it is customary for a young hunter who kills an animal of a particular species for the first time to treat it according to a particular ritual. Among the Achuar, for example, the young man declines to eat the game that he has brought home, for the still fragile relationship established with this new species would be irrevocably shattered if he did not show such restraint, and his prey's fellows would, in the future, conceal themselves at his approach. Among the Ojibwa of Ontario, the same principle appears to dictate the behavior of a novice hunter. In this case, although he will eat his catch in the company of his fellow hunters, he does so only in the course of a ceremonial meal that ends with a kind of funerary ritual that disposes of the animal's remains. A hunter's relationship with animals may take other forms over and above these marks of consideration. Seduction, for example, in which the prey is seen as a lover, or magic coercion that annihilates the animal's willpower and forces it to approach the hunter. But the most common of such relationships, and the one that best emphasizes the parity between humans and animals, is the bond of friendship that the hunter establishes over time with one particular member of the species. This forest friend is regarded as a companion who will serve as an intermediary among his fellow creatures, who, without balking, will then expose themselves within the range of a shot. No doubt it does involve a minor act of treachery on the intermediary's part, but this is of no consequence to his fellows, as the hunter's victim will soon be reincarnated in an animal of the same species, provided its remains have received the prescribed ritual treatment. For whatever the strategies employed to incite an animal to expose itself to a hunter, when the prey delivers itself up to the one who will consume it, it is always out of a feeling of generosity. The animal is moved by the compassion that it feels for the sufferings of humans, creatures that are vulnerable to famine, who depend upon itself for their survival. Far from being nothing more than an episodic technical manipulation of the autonomous natural environment, here hunting involves a continuous dialogue during which, as Tim Ingold observes, both human and animal persons are constituted with their particular identities and purposes. Unquote. Now, not only is that cool and very interesting to think about, it also speaks to the faults of the hunting magic hypothesis. That very popular explanation in early rock art studies, right? I said that it kind of separates the art from the society in general, right? And, you know, this kind of speaks to the danger of separating hunting from the society in general, right? Hunting's tied up in the whole cosmology of the given culture. It's not just, ooh, I need meat, I eat meat, I get meat, right? It's not this like purely utilitarian thing. It involves the whole culture and their whole cosmology. Anyways, back to North American shamanisms and other hallucinatory practices. Lewis Williams says that the commonalities between it and the Southern African accounts he's familiar with are striking. Quote, entry into the rock, movement through a tunnel, encounters with spirits and animals, emergence elsewhere through water, flight, and nasal hemorrhaging are experiences common to both continents. Unquote. Some anthropological reports note that various indigenous cultures don't view rock art as being made by the shaman or the vision quester. Rather, they refer to spirits as the creators of the images. Although, this could be because the shaman was so intrinsically tied to his helper spirit or other spirits that the boundary between them was fuzzy. They didn't have what philosopher Charles Taylor calls buffered selves, his word for the disenchanted individualism of secular modernity. Instead, their selves were porous, the boundary between the self, whether physical, mental, spiritual, and the world, was conceptualized differently. The self was often entered by outside forces. In Christianity, a common form of this porous self is demonic possession. Taylor says that a key part of secular modernity is this more solid, impenetrable boundary between self and world. Moderns understand their self as a clearly defined thing in the world, not something interpenetrated by outside forces. For an example of what this can look like, McKim Marriott and Ronald Inden, in their 1977 paper, Toward an Ethno-Sociology of South Asian Caste Systems, invent the concept of the dividual to contrast against the notion of the individual. They describe this viewpoint that's found in many South Asian cultures. They say, quote, individuals do not exist in South Asia as ultimate valorized units of society. The indigenous ethno-sociology holds that single persons are not ultimately individual units. Instead, persons are dividuals, or unique composites of diverse, subtle, and gross substances derived ultimately from one source, And they are also divisible into separate particles that may be shared or exchanged with others. South Asian thought embraces a positively valued sub-individual atomism as a means of systematizing moral or social complexity. The coded bodily atoms of South Asian social thought are acquired by transfers from various sources and are disposed of by transfers toward various destinations. Some substances are acquired originally from the seed and food provided by the parents before birth. Others are acquired by later addition through ingestion of food, sexual intercourse, and other means of reception, including sensation. Particles separable from the body, hair, sweat, semen, etc., are disposed of through excretion and reproduction by the living, and later through dissemination of the gross and subtle remains of the dead. Persons and genera are thus conceived of as channeling and transforming heterogeneous, ever-flowing, changing substances. Living beings naturally and properly may seek to acquire the most appropriate substances for themselves through right eating, right marriage, and other right exchanges and actions. This indigenous scientific view of flowing substance and striving persons as the normal state of affairs contrasts with previous Western characterizations of South Asian thought as concerned largely with maintaining static compartments, closed classes, and boundaries, unquote. So, to translate that out of academic language, Marriott and Inden proposed that we think of the South Asian indigenous subject broadly as a individual because of how they conceptualize the self as porous, something Taylor thinks is common outside of secular modernity. The South Asian self in particular is conceptualized as being made of particles that are often exchanged with other people and other parts of the world around them, right? There's not this unit called the self that's at the base of all sociality. The self can exchange parts of it with others. It's really interesting. I'm not sure how widespread that is in South Asia. I'd love to know more about it. Charles Taylor offers another example of the porous self from the West. He says, quote, "Modern Westerners have a clear boundary between mind and world, even mind and body. Moral and other meanings are in the mind. They cannot reside outside, and thus the boundary is firm. But formerly, it was not so. Let us take a well-known example of influence inhering in an inanimate substance, as this was understood in earlier times. Consider melancholy. Black bile was not the cause of melancholy. It embodied. It was melancholy. The emotional life was porous here. It didn't simply exist in an inner mental space. Our vulnerability to the evil, the inwardly destructive, extended to more than just spirits that are malevolent. It went beyond them to things that have no wills, but are nevertheless redolent with the evil meanings. See the contrast. A modern is feeling depressed, melancholy. He is told, it's just your body chemistry, you're hungry, or there's a hormone malfunction, or whatever. Straight away he feels relieved. He can take a distance from this feeling, which is ipso facto declared not justified. Things don't really have this meaning, it just feels this way, which is the result of a causal action utterly unrelated to the meanings of things. This step of disengagement depends on our modern mind-body distinction, and the relegation of the physical to being just a contingent cause of the psychic. But a pre-modern may not be helped by learning that his mood comes from black bile, because this doesn't permit a distancing. Black bile is melancholy. Now he just knows he's in the grips of the real thing." Unquote. So as we continue talking about rock art and its possible shamanic influences, think about that. Think about how, there's this idea that non-modern cultures have a different understanding of the self than we do, right? Their self is porous. It's interpenetrated by outside forces. Meanings reside in things as well as in the mind. So think about how the meaning of the cave might change with that change in perspective. Anyways, back to rock art. One Native American told a researcher that the shamans painted their spirits on the rocks to, quote, show themselves, to let people see what they had done, unquote. Like with the sand, there is evidence that North American cultures didn't believe that the rock art was just an inert representation. For example, the Kauai Sioux of modern-day California believe that a spirit named Rock Baby lives in rock and was the creator of the rock paintings. The paintings made by Rock Baby had power. If you touched them, they could make you sleepy or kill you. People in other Amerindian cultures also attribute rock art to what my culture would call spirits, often named things like rock babies, like water babies or mountain dwarves. Those are some other examples. Lewis Williams, of course, says that these similarities are because all humans have essentially the same nervous system. In fact, David Whitley, that archaeologist, has done further analysis of the North American indigenous rock art with these laboratory hallucination studies in mind, like Lewis Williams did with the San, and he claims to have found evidence of all three stages of hallucination. Lewis Williams also points to some examples in the ethnographic record from around the world of shamans using caves. He says, quote, "In Central Australia, an aspirant Aranda medicine man goes to the mouth of a cave where he falls asleep. Spirits then throw invisible lances at him, piercing his neck and cutting off his head. Similarly, but on the other side of the globe, a Smith Sound Inuit initiate must go to a cliff containing caves. If he is predestined to become a shaman, he will enter a cave. As soon as he has entered the cave, it closes behind him and does not open again until some time later." Unquote. I'll end this section with a description of Salinen Cave, a site of rock art in California, by archaeologist Thor Conway. He describes seeing these paintings for the first time. Quote, "Red and black paintings surround two small holes bored into the side of the walls by natural forces. As you stare at these entrance ways to another realm, suddenly, and without voluntary control, the pictographs break the artificial visual reality that we assume. Suddenly, the paintings encompassing the recessed pockets begin to pulse, beckoning us inward. The added effects, a nighttime setting, firelight, shadows dancing on the walls, and the resonation of Aboriginal chanting could induce even more powerful experiences." Unquote. So David Lewis Williams takes all of this and looks at the famous European cave art sites with this as the foundation. Remember how in the Deleuze and Guattari episodes we talked about that dichotomy between abstract and representational art? A classic dichotomy in cave art studies and art studies generally that Deleuze and Guattari wanted to abandon or challenge. David Lewis Williams kind of also puts them on the same plane, kind of abandoning it as well, but from this other direction. He says that both the geometric and representational images are related to hallucinations, just different stages. However, he mentions that there are some geometrical shapes in those Western European caves that aren't seen in the laboratory hallucination studies, so take that how you will. It's interesting though, Lewis Williams says things kind of in line with Matt Gatton in episode 3.2, that idea that didn't really make too much sense to me, that before anybody made a representational image, someone would have to know that representation was possible. Lewis Williams takes this seriously and says that, therefore, it must have been invented every now and again by someone and then spread from them as people learned about representation and techniques to achieve it on the rock walls and plaquettes. But he says, maybe there's a deeper explanation. And, you know, maybe I was so underwhelmed by Matt Gatton's version of it, because it was just sort of an offhand mention, rather than something in depth. Lewis Williams says it over many pages and in different ways, and still gets to a conclusion that is sort of outside of it. Different than Gatton or Nigel Spivey's short description of the problem, a lot of it ties into something I'm going to talk about next episode, about learning to see. It's related to what we talked about in series 1 too, about how you need to learn to see a 3D image on a 2D surface. So before humans made images, the thinking goes, they first needed to learn to see it as an image of something else. Representational images, of course, so maybe this is another example of the mimetic curse. This is why Lewis Williams says something else that connects to earlier episodes, those Homo aestheticus ones. He said that image making couldn't have come from body painting. They are too different for the learning to see one to transfer into the learning to see the other. The conventions and forms are too different. One's in 3D, one's in 2D. One you sculpt on all sides with your hands, one you put paint onto a surface. One counterpoint I can think of is that body painting could have been the first example of paint, which could have led to wall painting, even if other things were also necessary, right? Anyways, he does spend some time talking about the theories of Whitney Davis, an art historian who does kind of make some observations and suggestions in line with episodes 3.2 and 3.3. He says that people were haphazardly making marks as they lived, and likely the marks were either random or used for something else before they saw them as something else. I want to take a brief divergence here, because there's a really cool connection. In the 1960s or 70s, two mathematicians were in a debate about artificial intelligence. This was the first time that artificial intelligence was, you know, something that everybody was obsessed with, like now. Their names were Stanislaw Ulam and Giancarlo Rota. Ulam said to Rota, quote, "The time has come to enrich formal logic by adding to it some other fundamental notions. What is it that you see when you see? You see an object as a key, a man in a car as a passenger, some sheets of paper as a book. It is the word as that must be mathematically formalized. Until you do that, you will not get very far with your AI problem." Unquote. Rota was a bit taken aback. He responded that this is quite a challenging task, formalizing seeing something as something else in like a mathematical way. But Ulam responded, "Do not lose your faith. A mighty fortress is our mathematics." Do you see where I'm going? I'll let you mull over the implications there. It might help to read that E.H. Gombrich quote again about the first artists and the artist's metaphorical mind. I think I read this in like 3.2 or something, but he says, quote, "The artist's gift is of this order. He's the man who has learned to look critically, to probe his perceptions by trying alternative interpretations, both in play and in earnest. Long before painting achieved the means of illusion, man was aware of ambiguities in the visual field and had learned to describe them in language. Similes, metaphors, the stuff of poetry, no less than of myth, testify to the powers of the creative mind to create and dissolve new classifications. It is the unpractical man, the dreamer whose response may be less rigid and less sure than that of his more efficient fellow, who taught us the possibility of seeing a rock as a bull, and perhaps a bull as a rock." An artist of our own day, George Brock, has recently spoken of the thrill and awe with which he discovered the fluidity of our categories, the ease with which a file can become a shoehorn, a bucket, a brassier, unquote. So, a preeminent art historian thinks that seeing something as something else, is integral to art. And two respected mathematician philosophers think that seeing as is necessary for human-like intelligence. Very interesting to me. Perhaps this is another way into the Homo aestheticus argument, the notion that art and human can't really be separated. Whitney Davis, however, falters when he gets to how exactly seeing became seeing as, but he does say that as markings became more common and more complex, it became more and more likely that some human-made marking would be seen as something in the real world, and that seeing as would be replicated, or would eventually be replicated. Davis has a cool way of saying this. He says, quote, "In sum, the emergence of representation is the predictable logical and perceptual consequence of the increasing elaboration of the man-made visual world." Unquote. This can be in line with the Homo aestheticus notion by saying that maybe this is the sort of thing that humans do fairly naturally. Maybe not everyone, but certainly not like it was invented by one person at one specific time. I like that though, it's a predictable, logical, and perceptual consequence of the increasing elaboration of the man-made visual world. You know, as people made more and more markings and changed their environment the way that they wanted to, more and more, eventually somebody would see something as something else. Hey, that mark you made kind of looks like that thing in nature, you know? However, we have to consider why the existing images that we have are only of some things and not others. They were looking for certain things to represent. Aurochs, cave bears, mammoths in Europe, and, you know, kangaroos and whales in other places. This is much more narrow than the amount of possible things that prehistoric people could have made images of. Lewis Williams presents this as a big issue for Davis's hypothesis, but it makes sense to me that their attention would be focused on the large animals that they hunted and the large animals that could hunt them, right? That's certainly what would interest me as a hunter-gatherer, I'd think. That's probably what I'd base my cosmology off of if I happened to be a Paleolithic person. But we still have that question that Davis left us with. How did seeing as arise? Remember back to episodes 1.21, I think, about how people unaccustomed to 3D images on 2D surfaces often can't really recognize it? Same with other pictorial conventions, or the conventions of the movie, or even cave art itself, as we'll see next episode. People have to learn to see man-made images. There's no neutral way of image making, and there's no neutral way of image seeing, even though there might seem like there is. Again, we'll see this in the future. So how did the first person to do so invent images, invent seeing as? Lewis Williams says that to figure out why, we have to go back to the idea that consciousness is a spectrum. But just for a taste, he gives a brief answer. He says, quote, "In short, people did not invent two-dimensional images of things in their material environment. On the contrary, a notion of images and the vocabulary of motifs were part of their experience before they made wall or portable images." Unquote. Lewis Williams builds upon the work of Gerald Edelman, who said that there is something called primary consciousness, which is mere awareness of the present moment via sensory data, something that many animals, along with the human animal, have, and there is also something called higher order consciousness, which is an awareness of the present moment, but also how it fits into the past and how it fits into a projected future, something that only animals have, according to Edelman. Edelman doesn't say how this higher order consciousness was developed, though. This is where Lewis Williams takes over and suggests that it was developed in Africa before modern humans spread elsewhere, and is inextricably connected to the level of complexity that human language has. This is why Neanderthals adopted some things from the very similar people living near them, but not others, and is likely related to why they're no longer around, whereas humans very much are. I wonder if this matches with contemporary understandings of Neanderthals 2 decades later. I know that there was that big book called Kindred released recently about them. I'd be curious to know. Anyways, the main point is that this higher form of consciousness allowed for Homo sapiens to involve more of the past and the future in their present. An example of what this could look like is much more complex planning for hunts or more complex funeral rituals, since there was a more complex notion of where the dead were going. You know, stuff like this. And, you know, I suppose this increased complexity in understanding the present kind of happened at the same time with the hypothesized increase in complexity of language. So it makes me wonder how inextricable these things are, or like whether it's all kind of related. But here's where we get back to art. Lewis Williams says that to understand how all this ties together, we must think back to his idea that consciousness is a spectrum. As higher order consciousness was developed, how individuals and societies experience and understood this spectrum was altered. For example, with a better sense of the past, like a better memory, and a more complex language, dreams and hallucinations could be recalled with much more thoroughness and complexity, which would lead from the scientific materialist perspective to the development of cosmologies among different cultures that involve other worlds. And of course, their world was also porous, just like themselves, right? So these other worlds encroached upon this one, they're connected to this world. They're worlds that people, especially some people, can travel to, worlds that all people can glimpse in dreams or in art. This is what Lewis Williams means when he says that, quote, "In short, people did not invent two-dimensional images of things in their material environment. On the contrary, a notion of images and the vocabulary of motifs were part of their experience before they made wall or portable images," unquote. Right? Dreams are images. Our brains clearly love making images. Even when our bodies are trying to relax, they're like, hey, you, what if you're a pirate? Oh my god, you're on a ship, whoa, watch out for that guy with a cutlass, whoa. And then you wake up, and nowadays, many people's scientific materialistic brain goes, oh, just kidding, yeah, that wasn't real, let's have some breakfast. But I always love thinking about how insane dreams would be before the invention of this scientific materialist framework, this idea that, you know, at the base of everything is inert matter. That took a long time to develop, right? So just imagine, like, trying to experience that without what you've read in textbooks. Every time you fall asleep, you experience, like, all this insane stuff, other worlds, other times, places, everything mixed together. Lewis Williams wonders if this is a major, yet perhaps underappreciated, cause of the seemingly natural human drive to make myths and religions. It's often attributed largely to the existence of death, which is also probably a big factor, but I'd never really thought too hard until now about how impactful dreaming may have been on an early religion. And other animals dream. Like, I'm sure many of you have seen YouTube videos of, like, sleeping dogs whose legs are moving so they're chasing something. But the idea is that with higher order consciousness, humans are able to remember their dreams, or at least humans can remember the dreams with much more exactitude, and then they have language to relay it to others with increased exactitude. Dogs dreaming are just living in the present, according to Edelman and Lewis Williams, but their present just happens to be in the dream world at that moment. So maybe, Lewis Williams says, the reason humans predominated and other apes, like the Neanderthals, died out is because of dreams. Maybe instead of, or alongside, Homo aestheticus, we are Homo somnia, or something. Homo memoria. And maybe instead of inventing or discovering the theory of two-dimensional images before consciously making them, maybe images of reality are a big part of the spectrum of consciousness. And with higher order consciousness, these eight images were able to be remembered, and then at some point recreated. My friend and I were talking recently about mental imagery, and we were trying to figure out if the images we see in our minds, like, you know, like a memory of the past day, for example, a snapshot of a moment, whether that's actually three-dimensional in our minds, or whether it just, like, feels that way, if that makes sense. We were discussing this around a campfire and intoxicated, so I can't remember exactly what we said or concluded, and I'd love your thoughts as well. But a big part of it was how synesthetic our senses really are. Both my friend and I have read a bit about that. I'm using the word synesthetic or synesthesia a little loosely here. Synesthesia is that thing that some people have where certain things are mixed in their minds. Certain categories are connected. Like people who have this deep, inextricable feeling that Mondays are brown, Tuesdays are yellow. The other days of the week are certain colors in a way that goes beyond metaphor. For example, there's a scholarly debate based on some of his personal letters about whether Vincent van Gogh was a synesthete, because he says he very strongly associates sounds with colors. To him, sounds have a color. But there's another academic debate that brings us back to mental imagery. How, again, using the word in a loose way, how synesthetic every person's senses and sense processing is. I'll probably make future episodes that go further into this idea somewhere down the line, but there's some research and some more theoretical philosophizing that says that our bodies play a very prominent role in sensory processing. Some think that the unity of the body is primary in our sensory processing than the distinctions between our senses. The distinctions between our senses is secondary to the unity of the body. I hope that makes sense. Like in other words, when we think about the senses, we typically split them up into five, maybe more if you're a nerd, but we split them up and then say that these different sensations come via different mechanisms and body parts. Smell through the nose, sight through the eyes, touch through the skin, taste through the tongue, sound through the ears, and then they are processed by the brain. And out of this, our experience arises. But this other way of understanding is kind of the opposite. The fact that all our senses are processed in the same place, the brain or the body, that means that they're all kind of mixed together. And this mixing is more important than the fact that we see through our eyes and hear through our ears. It's very uncommon that we are seeing something and like plugging our ears completely, or hearing something and closing our eyes and not opening them. Plus, there are studies that show that the boundaries between our senses are less impermeable than most people naively think. I talked in series one about this somewhere, about how studies show that what we feel on our skin can affect the sounds we hear, stuff like that. Not super dramatically, like it's not like if you touch somebody in a certain way they hear like a choir, but you know, it is there. And for a summary of this kind of thinking, I'll just quote a passage from the media theorist Mark Hansen. He says, quote, "To find concrete support for this view, we could turn to the work in phenomenological aesthetics from Erwin Strauss and Henri Maldini to Jose Gil and Brian Massumi, where the synesthetic capacities of the body are shown to precede the experiences of discrete sensory modalities. Alternatively, we could cite the work on infant psychology by Daniel Stern, where an amodal proto-sensory flux is similarly shown to precondition the differentiation of the sense modalities. Or again, we could invoke Deleuze's concept of a transcendental sensibility that foregrounds the reality-constituting function of the senses prior to and independently of their coordination in the philosophemes of object recognition and common sense." Unquote. Sorry if that was a little wordy. Another way into this is to look at certain ways linear perspective has been described. Bernard Berenson summarizes the thoughts of the late 19th century sculptor Adolf Hildebrand by saying, quote, "The painter can accomplish his task only by giving tactile values to retinal impressions," unquote. So the idea is that we only see in three dimensions normally, not just because of our eyes, but also because of our sense of touch and our memories of how we've seen those things or similar things before, our sense of touch that feels the curves and depth and textures and stuff that we see. But when the painter has to paint a scene in 3D, they have to find a way to translate all of this into a purely visual sense. Only with memory and touch do we see that basketball sitting over there as a sphere, not a circle. But the painter must atone for this lack in the painting. Well, I mean, somewhat, I guess, because I guess if it looks like a basketball in the painting, or it's on a basketball court, you know, our memory still plays a role. We go, oh, there's a basketball, it's probably a sphere. But anyways, it's still interesting to think about that, giving tactile values to retinal impressions. Yeah. So, are our memories of a scene, or person, or object three-dimensional, or does it just feel three-dimensional? And there's actually this like mixture of senses and feeling and stuff. Interesting question. Lewis Williams is, of course, not just interested in the mental imagery that comes with things like memory and planning, but also the mental imagery we call hallucinations. And here there are some things that strengthen his argument. Lewis Williams points to laboratory evidence from some of those hallucination studies that found that lots of people see their hallucinations as projected onto surfaces, like walls or ceilings. You know, it's kind of like a projection film, right? But in case you just think that this is just a thing for hallucinating people who are used to projected images in the movie theater, luckily, Lewis Williams also points to some anthropology. This person named Rachel Dolmatoff, who did some field work on the Tucano people of the Northern Amazon, and found that the Tucano people see their mental imagery similarly, like projected onto planes. So it's not just a thing for people used to projections in the movie theater. Using this evidence, Lewis Williams hypothesizes that two-dimensional imagery is a feature of the human mind, but in altered states, which is why this has been underemphasized by modern researchers. They have a bias towards thinking about rational waking thought, confusing that with human thought in general. Lewis Williams summarizes, saying, quote, "People did not invent two-dimensional images, nor did they discover them in natural marks. On the contrary, their world was already invested with two-dimensional images. Such images were a product of the functioning of the human nervous system in altered states of consciousness, and in the context of higher order consciousness." Unquote. Lewis Williams also says something interesting about shamanism. He says that this mental form of image making is important for the social functioning of shamanism, but it isn't always turned into physical images, what we'd call artistic images. That sort of thing arises for probably a lot of reasons, but you need reasons for it to arise. That's why not all cultures have a tradition of image making. In specific places, it's easier or harder to make images. First of all, like, not everyone has natural paint easily accessible. So, you know, some societies have higher barriers to image making than others. But I just love this reversal of Lewis Williams's. And even though I was nervous for a sec, he deftly avoids the mimetic curse with this move. You might not see how, though. Another quote by him, he says, quote, "The first two-dimensional images were thus not two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional things in the material world, as researchers have always assumed. Rather, they were fixed mental images," unquote. So whether the art is what we call geometric or abstract or representational, they all come from this same source, fixing mental imagery, just different stages of hallucinations. Lewis Williams even says that probably the prehistoric people who made the images in the caves didn't see them as representing real-life animals, but rather understood them as an expression or a fixing in the physical world of things they saw, as they understood the spectrum of consciousness in a radically different way to us, seeing dreams and visions and nightmares as just as real as what became known many thousands of years later as matter. This is his explanation for why animals in cave art don't have a shared ground and a scene. They're all kind of floating, and some are this way, some are that way. Also, not just a ground to stand on is missing. Often, many of the animals don't have their hooves painted, and Lewis Williams thinks that this explains this as well. The animals aren't drawn standing because they aren't representations of animals standing on the plains above ground out there. They are floating in the strange worlds of one's mind, however it was conceptualized prehistorically. Lewis Williams imagines complimenting a prehistoric painter of, let's say, Chauvet, for how realistic the cave lion paintings are, and getting a bewildered response, because to the painter, realistic is not a compliment, because the goal is not representation of the real. The goal wasn't to paint a buffalo that looked as much as possible like the buffalo they hunted the previous day. The goal was to fix in place the image of the buffalo that was in their mind, a buffalo that is also real. How exactly this was conceived is something we'll likely never know. An early 20th century scholar who partially focused on cave art, Solomon Reinach, tells of how he once met a Turkish officer in Greece who was Muslim, and some type of Muslim that had restrictions against viewing any pictorial images. The officer couldn't understand a drawing of a horse, quote, because he could not move around it, unquote. Same with the Ngoni people in episode 1.21. Perhaps prehistoric people would respond similarly, saying, what do you mean by realistic? It's clearly not a realistic cave line. You can't walk around it and look at its other side. What are you talking about? Lewis Willem says, quote, for the makers, the paintings and engravings were visions, not representations of visions, as indeed was the case for the Southern African San and the North American shamans. I argue that, at a given time and for social reasons, the projected images of altered states were insufficient and people needed to fix their visions. They reached out to their emotionally charged visions and tried to touch them, to hold them in place, perhaps on soft surfaces and with their fingers. They were not inventing images, they were merely touching what was already there. Unquote. Now, I think the issue of seeing as is still maybe a question, but perhaps its importance has been eroded a little when it's looked at from this new perspective. Our brains are image-making machines, so learning to see images isn't as huge a step as it might have seemed before. But still, even if the prehistoric people didn't think of it as seeing as, you still have to see markings as a bison that was seen in a vision, right? Something to ponder. Lewis Williams definitely brings us closer to an answer, though, I think. And it's really cool. This is another quite different lens where we get to a similar conclusion to the Homo aestheticus episodes, that art wasn't invented by some guy at one time and then spread out from there, or invented by a few people. It is intimately, inextricably tied to the type of consciousness and cognition that humans have. I found this idea very, very lovely, very poetic, borderline mythological. Anyways, this episode's gone on long enough, so we'll wrap up talking about Lewis Williams next episode, kind of tying it into a more complete vision, while also traveling to another rock art tradition that we haven't covered yet. I'll see you next time.